and the virtuoso violinist for the occasion, my guest again in the studio today. And welcome back to the Midday, Rachel Barton Pine.
Hi, great to be here.
Up from Chicago for a performance tonight?
Yes, indeed. This is the first time in my entire life that I've ever had a concerto engagement during Christmas week.
I wondered about that. You usually have a kind of a lull week during the holidays?
Exactly. Of course, every other musician has holiday gigs, but as a violin soloist, all the orchestras are busy with Nutcrackers and Messiahs rather than, you know, Brook or Mendelssohn concertos. So I usually spend the time with friends and family. But I'm delighted to be here. This is a treat.
It was a treat for everybody who will be there, of course, because first of all, it's a free concert. Wisconsin yeah. Chamber Orchestra. And you're performing the Saint-Saëns' third violin concerto, and there are other works on the program as well, featuring Ketrider Foss and also, of course, the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, led by Andrew Sewell. And that's at the brand new Hamel Music Center in Madison, so it's a chance for people who attend the concert to find out about that, too.
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful hall. We enjoyed rehearsing in it last night, and it's going to be a fun program.
Before we hear some live Rachel Barton Pine violin artistry, I just wanted a quick question about the Saint-Saëns. It has a reputation for being difficult, not so much technically, but in terms of interpretation, kind of finding the thread that ties it all together. Do you find true?
It's interesting when you go around the world performing, not only concertos that should be played more often, like the Saint-Georges that you just spun, but also, you know, of course, primarily the famous beloved concertos, Tchaikovsky, Sibelius, Brahms, etc., etc. You start to have different ways that you think about them, like, well, this one is the sweatiest, or this one needs the most advanced preparation. What's interesting is certain concertos that you would think, if I haven't played it for 9 months, maybe it would be a little out of tune and need to get back in shape. I pick up the violin and it's shockingly okay. Like, the fingers land exactly in the right spot. Saint-Saëns is always in the opposite direction. It seems, when you look at the page, like it should be one of the easier concertos. And certainly, it's one of the ones that you learn younger in your development, before you play Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. And, you do learn the Saint-Saëns earlier on after Brook and Mendelssohn. I learned it myself when I was about 11 years old. And that's just because it's shorter. It doesn't take as much physical strength. Emotionally, it doesn't take quite as much depth of, there's no great moments of angst or anything like that. Doesn't mean it's an easy kids concerto or anything like that, but you have to learn something, and it is earlier on in the pedagogical list. So you'd think, oh, it'd be easy to come back to it, but actually something about the purity of sound and the way that the harmonies are configured, it's so exposed and it's so treacherous, and I always have to spend inordinate amounts of time making sure that it's in tune, which is definitely worth it, but it always gets me every time, like, wait, how can this not be in tune? It's not one of the harder concertos, but yet I guess it is. But yeah, trying to find that balance between, I think the problem is that we play so many Germanic concertos, this big bombastic, yes. And then of course the Russian concertos are very aggressive, and to approach the instrument with a little bit more of a sense of delicacy and yet still have a large, performance feel to it in a big hall. It's a careful balancing act that you have to achieve so that you have this refinement of sound going on. And it's a pleasure to seek for that and kind of a nice respite from some of the more crash and burn types of repertoire.
Is this the violin that you're going to be playing the Saint-Saëns on tonight?
Oh, indeed. My usual 1742 Quinari del Gesu, the one picked by Brahms for the 19th century woman soloist Marie Soldat.
Wow. That's something just to see it, let alone to touch it in the way that you do.
I'm very lucky, for sure.
And we're going to be even luckier because you're going to play it for us. You've got some things that you're willing to share with our audience during the midday today.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll just start us off with some Bach. I think we all listen to a lot of Baroque music at holiday time. This, of course, has nothing to do with the holidays, but this is the first movement of the first sonata that he wrote for unaccompanied violin. But it's really unaccompanied is a misnomer, because what the violin is really doing is accompanying itself.
What you might call the Bach effect, and that's something that kind of just draws you in, maybe gives you a kind of a feeling of, well, serenity, or some kind of intellectual journey. And that was from which of the unaccompanied suites, Rachel?
So that was the Adagio from the Sonata Number 1 in G Minor, BWV 1001.
And what do you experience when you play a piece like that?
Oh, you know, I actually grew up playing Bach's music in my church, and it was in a German congregation, I think founded in 1843 by an immigrant Chicago community, and we actually have a stained glass window of Bach in our sanctuary, so it's like, guy really? From the Bible, guy from the Bible, Bach, guy from the Bible.
That's unusual.
I was embarrassingly old before I realized that Bach wasn't in the Bible, but I grew up, some of my earliest times, I don't want to call it a performance, but some of the earliest occasions on which I played the violin before a group of people was playing the music of Bach during worship when I was 4 and 5 years old. And yeah, his music just brings me to a really spiritual place. I think even his secular music, you know, he himself was so spirit-filled that there's just that sense of something greater than yourself, you know, regardless of your beliefs. You know, I think we feel something in the music of Bach that's takes us, you know, to something beyond us.
Something timeless too, I would think. Now, we started out with one of your earlier recordings from like 1997, 1998, the Chevalier de Saint-Georges, and that's from an interesting collection.
Yeah, so that was part of an album with the, nowadays we have catchy album titles, but back then it had the very academic title of Violin Concertos by Black Composers from the 18th and 19th Centuries. There's a mouthful for you. And in fact, these Black composers were Afro-Caribbean and Afro-European because no Americans were writing violin concertos in the 1700s. And this album, honestly, I really made it because they were great concertos that had either been never recorded or rarely recorded, and it was awesome music that I wanted to share with the public, and I naively wasn't thinking about the social justice element or anything like that. It was just, here's some great classical music. But the most unexpected, life-changing things started to happen after the release of this album, you know, a little more than 20 years ago. I started getting invited to sit on diversity panels. I started getting requests from students, parents, and teachers, you know, for, you know, my kid is at Suzuki Book 4 level, where can I find a piece by a Black composer for them? Things like that. And I realized that there was a need out there that geeks like me would read academic journals that would discuss, you know, the 19th century Black orchestras of America, or the fact that Frederick Douglass played the violin, all this history, but that information really wasn't out there, and nor was the music, because a lot of it had never been published, was in manuscript only, or had long been out of print for reasons of historic discrimination. So you just couldn't get your hands on it if you were just, you know, the average teacher in the average town somewhere in America. So I had recently started a foundation for the purpose of young artist support with our instrument loan program and financial assistance program, and I realized, okay, I've got a 501c3 not-for-profit, and there's this research project. I love music research. I love music education. I should just go for it. So I was lucky enough to get a lot of heavy hitters in the realm of Black music research, pedagogy, conductors, composers, people who knew a lot more than I did back in those days, who agreed to be on my advisory board, and we put together a scheme for creating a curriculum, not a replacement for the study of Bach, Mozart, and Vivaldi, but a supplemental curriculum that students of all races and ethnicities could be able to draw from at every stage along the way, from beginners to advanced students. And over about 15, 16 years, we collected more than 900 pieces by more than
900? I know there were a lot, but that's...
Yeah, and last fall of 18... we finally published our Violin Volume 1, which was really, really exciting, because not only did it feature Black composers from all over the world, excuse me, one sec, I'm battling a bit of a cold, I'm just going to take a drink here.
It's all real-time radio.
Art music, not folk music. North America, South America, the Caribbean, Europe, and Africa itself, and also music from the 18th through the 21st centuries, women composers. It's actually the most diverse curriculum for violin on a number of levels in existence, above and beyond the fact that it's Black composers. So I'm super excited about that. It's been being used all over the country for the past year, and we've gotten wonderful feedback from different teachers and parents and students. Really a dream come true. And in the meantime, we've also published a coloring book, and this arose because of parenthood. I was in my favorite sheet music store looking for coloring books of composers for my daughter, as one does. I was like, well, guess who's not in there? So we decided to publish our own of the 40 most important Black composers from history, including each of their biographies. So it's really, whether or not you choose to color it, it's actually a primer, you know, a kind of a jumping off point for starting to get to know this slice of the repertoire. We have a timeline poster of 300 Black composers, which is great for not only music, but also general education classrooms, and lots of resources on our musicbyblackcomposers.org website. And as a happy side effect, of course, I've added to my own personal repertoire with some of the grown-up level pieces that we've collected along the way, and just made my second Black Composers album that was released last year. It's called Blues Dialogues, kind of in homage to my hometown growing up with the Chicago blues alongside classical. And all of the pieces in one way or another are inspired by the blues, which of course is, you know, but a fraction of the voices of various Black composers. But I found some amazing pieces from about 100-year span, mostly African-American, and some real treasures in there.
Well, Coleridge Taylor is one of the great ones. Samuel Coleridge Taylor.
So Samuel Coleridge Taylor is actually not on this album because his music was more kind of romantic, Victorian.
Sure.
Some of it inspired by spirituals. But now Samuel Coleridge Taylor is a very interesting case. He was often referred to as the Black Dvorak or the Black Mahler. Elgar was among his many fans. He was successful in Europe as a composer, conductor, and violinist. And W.E.B. Du Bois arranged for him to come over to the U.S., and Booker T. Washington actually wrote the foreword to his collection of concert spirituals. He was such an inspiring figure to African-American classical musicians in the late 19th, early 20th centuries when they were being excluded from mainstream concert life that a lot of their own organizations, musical societies and so on, they ended up calling them Samuel Coleridge Taylor societies in honor of their hero.
Well, he was a great writer, too. I mean, wrote a wonderful autobiography about his travels through America. This would have been circa 1900, and his observations on American culture and mores and that kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. And it's especially at Christmas time when the Messiah is ever present. It's astonishing to think that for a period of a number of decades, his Hiawatha oratorio, based on the poems of Longfellow, was the most frequently performed oratorio in the world, beating out even the Messiah.
How times change.
Yeah, so actually one of the composers on my Blues Dialogues album is one of my all-time favorite composers, and his name is Coleridge Taylor Perkinson. Perkinson's mother was just inspired by Samuel Coleridge Taylor and named her son as a first name, Coleridge-Taylor. Quite a first name. And she had no idea that her own son was going to grow up to also be a composer.
Not to be confused with the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
Yeah, no hyphen, white guy, totally different person. Exactly.
Spin that around a few times.
So Coleridge Taylor Perkinson, of course, didn't go by Coleridge Taylor. He went by Perk for all of his friends. And I was lucky to get to know him at the end of his life, which he spent in Chicago as music director of the New Black Music Repertory Ensemble.
Wow. Well, you're going to favor us with some Coleridge Taylor Perkinson in a second. And while you tune up, et cetera, or retune, let me just get in the station break and maybe a quick quiz question, too, and we'll be back right after this. And now back live with Rachel Barton Pine, who is in Madison to perform tonight the Saint-Saëns Third Violin Concerto with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra. It's a free concert, and if there are still tickets available, you can find out by going to their website at WCO, the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, and find out that way. And so we're hearing live music in our studio today. A real treat to have Rachel Barton Pine come up from Chicago to perform the concert tonight and share some with us, too. So let's see. Make sure I get the sequence right. Coleridge Taylor Perkinson.
Exactly. And this is his piece called Louisiana Blues Strut.
Thank you.
A strut indeed. And so I have to ask, I mean, it's a great piece, Rachel. You're playing a violin that's 280 years old. And I can't imagine that the maker would have imagined that this piece or anything like it would have been played on the instrument. And yet it holds up fine. How do we account for that?
Well, of course, it would have started its life as a Baroque violin with a shorter neck and gut strings and everything else. So, you know, from the late 1700s onwards, the makers would have been shocked to see these instruments undergo the major surgery and reconfiguration. Now, of course, violins get amplified and all kinds of stuff. So, but yeah, it's amazing that this tool, this great work of art, can take me everywhere from, you know, Baroque music to Metallica if I feel like it.
I was going to ask about the Metallica. What kind of balance do you get when you're playing Metallica on a 1740 violin?
Well, the wonderful thing about metal music, of course, is that so much of it is inspired by classical music. So playing it on classical instruments, but with a, you know, the right kind of emotion, really makes some kind of sense. I did a whole concert of my own string quartet arrangements of various rock and metal songs interspersed with stuff like Vivaldi and Shostakovich and Paganini in Singapore last month.
I bet they loved it there.
It worked really, really well. It felt like a chamber music concert, except, you know, of a slightly different variety than you might be used to.
Yeah, it's a fairly long, I wouldn't say tradition, but custom now, pattern that you see occasionally of these string quartet arrangements of, you know, I mean, it goes back to the Beatles, certainly, and probably before that.
Yeah, well, there's various approaches to it, and of course, some, you know, some ensembles choose to classicize the rock piece by making it sound, you know, a little more refined and dainty, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's definitely not my taste. You know, Shostakovich is, you know, just really hard-edged and shocking, and if you can do that in classical, why not keep it in the rock music?
Well, there's a lot of philosophy that can go into music, and as it develops over the course of time, a lot of variables that you can work in. What else might we elicit from you and your violin while you're in the studio here?
All right. Well, this is something I just worked back up for my recent Lincoln Center debut a couple weeks ago in New York. It wasn't on the program. It was on a special Lincoln Center offstage thing that they did. But anyways, it's a favorite piece of mine by Fritz Kreisler. Kreisler, of course, is known for all of his lovely little vignettes for violin and piano, Liebeslied and Schön Rosmarin and all these great little melodies. But he wrote just a couple of pieces for violin alone. And this one is a little bit more contemporary sounding, but, you know, still very, very tuneful. It was written for his friend and colleague, the great Belgian virtuoso Eugène Ysaÿe. And it has a little bit of an Ysaÿe flavor to it somehow, if you're familiar with Ysaÿe's
works. Ysaÿe had a little bit of an edge at times.
Yeah, and the first, well, it's called Recitativo and Scherzo. The first section, the recitativo, is very improvisatory in nature, and then the scherzo shows Kreisler's wonderful sense of humor. I especially love the way it ends, and if you play it well, the audience actually chuckles.
Here we go. Fritz Kreisler there, Rissa Tativ and Scherzo. So he did have a sense of humor that came out in various forms. I'm sure you've heard the story about his invitation to perform a concert, a private concert, for a wealthy matron. And she says, and will $1,000 fee be acceptable? And he says, yes, that will be acceptable. And she says, and we ask that after you perform that you not associate with the guests. And he said, in that case, madam, $500 will be acceptable.
I always wonder about that story. It seems like such an insult that she didn't want him to talk to her friends. And actually, I love that part of the job, traveling to different places and meeting people who love music. And, you know, I always think it's such a great pleasure.
Well, that's good.
But I know what Kreisler meant.
I'm sure occasionally there are snobs out there that you run into in this line of work in particular. We have one more that we can hear from Rachel. She has agreed to play several things live for us. And this one is a little bit, I'll say out there, but geographically.
Yes, indeed. And I always think about the Southern Hemisphere this time of year because they're enjoying the middle of their summer. And this I'm playing in honor of Andrew and Mary Sewell. Andrew, the conductor of the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra that I'm collaborating with tonight. We go back to the late 90s when I first appeared with the WCO. And I've
It's been that long.
Yeah, and I've collaborated with Andrew with the Wichita Symphony, with the Masterworks Festival, a couple of other places over the years. Of course, I've been in Madison for other things besides the WCO, most recently this fall with the Madison Symphony, which was such a great pleasure. But Andrew and his family have become personal friends. His son served as a ring bearer in our wedding way back when. And actually, he and Mary are godparents to my daughter. And it's just a wonderful relationship. It's great when you have excellent musicians who are also such nice people. And of course, they are from New Zealand. And so when I did my first tour of New Zealand back in 2000, I decided to write a theme and variations on the New Zealand national anthem. Paganini, of course, had given similar treatment to God Save the Queen or King, whichever one it was the year he wrote it.
Would have been the Queen by then, I believe,
I guess
Victoria.
So. But New Zealand didn't exist at that point. So none of those old dead famous guys like Paganini, Vieuxtemps, Ernst, none of them had written a New Zealand piece. So I decided to go ahead and be the one to do it.
And is that the official name, Variations on the New Zealand National Anthem?
Well, it's actually God Defend New Zealand. So the full title would be Introduction, Theme, and Variations on God Defend New Zealand.
And you wrote this for solo violin?
Exactly, so that I could play it for an encore with the NZSO. But it's fun to play anywhere, anytime.
Okay. Here we go. Rachel Barton Pine, composer and violinist. Thank you. Put a few fun things for yourself to do in there, didn't you?
Actually, I have to admit, the clever idea to play the theme in canon with one voice plucked and the other voice bowed was my husband's idea.
Oh, nice. But I mean, that's you mentioned Paganini earlier, and that's the kind of thing that he would like to do, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, Paganini wrote a famous set of variations on Nel corpo non mi sento, where he bows the melody and plucks an accompaniment. And then Ernst wrote a famous set of variations on The Last Rose of Summer, where he plucks the theme and plays an arpeggioed accompaniment with the bow. And to my knowledge, no one had ever had both voices play the theme in canon. So that was pretty fun. And I've gotten all kinds of responses over the years, like, you know, that maybe that was the duet between the English and the Maori people or the North and South Islands. Or
You do get all kinds of interpretations, don't you, that you didn't necessarily think of when you
were
writing the
music
piece.
Can mean something different to everyone and not necessarily what the composer even realized.
Well, your most recent recording is the Dvorak, which is one of the great violin concertos, and the Kachaturian, which is also, though probably less known than the Dvorak. But you have a long history with the Kachaturian.
Yeah, well, I learned both of the concertos when I was 15, and I've been fortunate to play them not as frequently as some of the top 10 concertos, but you know, on a regular basis over the years, and I've really lived and grown with them, and they really feel like a part of me at this point. And so it was really fun to pair them on album. Of course, they're from different centuries, different cultures, you know, Czechoslovakia and Armenia, respectively, but they both share a very, very strong sense of having the traditional music of the composer's ethnicity absolutely infused throughout the work, with the rhythms, melodies, harmonies, and in the case of Kachaturian, even the instrumentation, you know, clanging cymbals and snaky woodwind instruments and everything imitating the sonorities and timbres of
Armenia.
Yeah.
Yes. He was
Eastern European music.
He was a wonderful orchestrator, and you can just see his fingerprints on just about everything he does, can't you? Kachaturian.
Absolutely. Very unique voice.
Well, speaking of unique voices, thanks, Rachel Barton Pine, for sharing your two voices with us, or three if you count the two voices of the violin that we just heard. And
actually, it was the Kachaturian that I last played in Madison months ago.
We're hearing, we're hearing a little bit of it now from the first movement, the finale, and this is with the Scottish Royal Scottish National Orchestra, Teddy Abrams conducting. And again, Rachel is playing tonight at the Hamel Music Center, free concert with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, the Saint-Saëns Third Violin Concerto. And always a pleasure to see you.
Thanks again for having me.